The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 8th of September, 2020. On the podcast today, Paul Hill talks to Martin Gilbert, a giant in the fund investment industry. He's currently the chairman of Aberdeen Standard Investments. Previously, he was CEO of Aberdeen Asset Management, which he co-founded in 1983. Martin talks about where he's investing his money and specifically mentions the following companies: Prudential, JD Sports, Unilever, Dunelm, AstraZeneca, and in the US, Facebook, Alphabet, Tesla, Amazon, and Apple. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you can also see our COVID-19 index. And biggest rise of the day is Totally, up 5% to 18.13 pence. Biggest faller is Tizian Life Sciences, down 8%. To 130. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to have with me Martin Gilbert, entrepreneur, founder of Aberdeen Asset Management and giant across the fund management industry. Welcome, Martin.
Thank you.
Now, investors have made out like sort of bandits since the lows of March 23rd, and particularly in places like the tech and NASDAQ areas. What is your view broadly on sort of like equities and bonds going forward? Have the good days, are the good days now behind us, or can investors still expect good returns?
Gosh, that's a big question. I mean, I'm surprised at the level of markets are at the moment, especially equity markets, and especially the U.S. Equity market has performed far, far better than I expected. I suppose it's where else can you put your money, really, if you want to make a return over the next 5 to 10 years rather than equities? And a lot of the professional investors are, of course, buying private markets, i.e. non-public markets. But yeah, I'm cautious of the markets, but I'm a bad investor when it comes to markets. So, I've got these markets wrong.
You're sort of long-term positive, but short-term cautious. Would that sort of like?
Yeah, I would say so. And I'm especially long-term positive on Asia. I've always felt that Asia is the place to invest long-term, I would say.
And what about sort of like inflation, if we sort of split it down into sort of like CPI, which is being dragged down by technology and surplus labor, at least at the moment. And then we've got asset prices, which is, you know, the hard assets, things like gold and housing market. I mean, you've got sort of like you've got two levels of there. How do you see that playing out going forward?
Yeah, I mean, if you're fortunate enough to be able to borrow money and buy hard assets, as a lot of investors have been able to over the last sort of 5-10 years, they've done very well. I think the banks would like a bit of inflation to get them out of the sort of the levels of debt they've got, because certainly the central bank balance sheets have probably never been bigger. And we're sitting here with 200-year interest lows. So it is a good time to borrow if you've got the right asset to put it into.
And I saw Jerome Powell last week when he talked about sort of inflation expectations. They're sort of like tilting towards running the economy hard for longer than they'd previously anticipated. So if you get an inflation spike above 2%, then they're not going to turn off the tap.
No, I agree. I mean, I think they're terrified of putting interest rates up. So I'd suspect interest rates are going to remain low for longer than any of us think.
Yeah. And then just coming back to sort of like an area of, you know, your particular expertise in the sort of fund management space. I mean, for a long period, we've had huge amounts of fiscal and central bank stimulus, which has sort of like brought an asset correlation closely together and meant that sort of momentum and growth has significantly outperformed value. And you've seen that in NASDAQ compared to against something like the FTSE 100, which is populated by banks and energy, et cetera. Is there a time at all that you could see active managers, which is Aberdeen Asset Management and Standard Life, one of their specialisms. Do you see a time when active management can outperform the passives and the ETF trackers?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think if active fund managers don't outperform over the next period, because we're seeing massive disparity in equity performance. By disparity, I mean some sectors are doing well and some sectors are doing very badly. So active managers should theoretically do well in these more difficult markets.
Oh, and which particular sectors or areas is it? Have they got more chance of doing well in small caps rather than large caps, or in certain industries that outperform on energy, or you know, the mean reversion trade, or where would you see that outperformance occurring?
Oh, I mean, active asset managers should be able to outperform in small and mid cap. They should be able to outperform in less efficient markets like emerging market equities, emerging market debt, these sort of asset classes. But certainly, even in large cap at the moment, certain sectors are going to underperform. So, as I say, active managers should be able to do well there. Value has done badly for the last sort of 10 years. But I think buying good companies, growth companies at reasonable prices is a good trade at the moment. So buying quality rather than deep value is where I would see active guys doing well.
I think even Warren Buffett has been underperforming the indices for the last 20 years. And I think he's the best active manager. So it just shows you how difficult this is.
Yeah, it's interesting, his big bet in Japan, isn't it? He's betting that a lot of these Japanese companies are going to change and that Japan is going to do well. So, yeah, interesting.
There was a note, actually, from, I think it was Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, last week, and they were talking about the Japanization of the Western markets, that when you have a sort of low interest rate, low inflation environment, value tends to outperform. So, I think he might be sort of like going on that trade as well, but What is when you look at sort of like areas to invest in? What are sort of criteria you look for with sort of stock picking? If investors wanted to sort of like choose some of the big caps, the beaten up areas, maybe financials, energy, insurance, those areas that's particularly lagged. What are the criteria? What sort of like features would you sort of like advise investors to have a good sort of like look at?
Well, I think first of all, get to know the company, do a bit of research, and there's no reason that investors, even non-professional investors, can't sort of do a bit of research into a company, learn a bit about it. Secondly, get a good management team. A good management team will do well for you. And then if you look at the sort of beaten up sort of sectors, I wouldn't probably go into hospitality, travel just yet, because I still think there's a lot of pain to come in those sectors. Unless, of course, there is some sort of virus, sort of antivirus. So, I mean, I like things like the Pru, Unilever, AstraZeneca, JD Sports, Dunelm, these sort of boring sort of businesses at the moment, if I was looking at the UK market. But I like ASEAN. I've always liked the Southeast Asian markets because there's particular value there. Whereas India, which I do, great companies, but high valuations there as well at the moment.
Is the corporate governance okay in places like India? Because it appears...
Yeah, very good. Yeah, India's good. China's getting better and learning that if you do want people to invest, you've got to have decent corporate governance, especially in China. There's some very good companies below the sort of state-owned enterprise giants. So the Asia market is an especially good place to find good quality companies. But yeah, corporate governance in India is usually pretty good, and ASEAN is also okay.
And what about sort of like, you know, when you talk about management, sort of rock star CEOs and people, you know, sort of Tesla, you've got Elon Musk and you've got, you know, the Mark Zuckerberg out in Facebook, and their businesses are absolutely flying. They're doing really well. And some of the corporate governance issues, particularly on sort of like dual class shares, non-voting shares, and they sort of run over a lot of these traditional shareholder requirements. How do you balance that off with an excellent business with a management team that's unusual?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because traditional corporate governance would mean that you wouldn't invest in these sort of companies. So you really do need to make a decision if you're going to sometimes the entrepreneurial founder will be chairman and CEO of the business. He'll have sort of controlling votes, all of these sort of things. So you're right. You've just got to make a decision, because they don't fit into what I would term traditional UK corporate governance sort of bucket of separate chairman, CEO, no dual share classes. So yeah, it's sort of as I say, a decision you need to make.
Yeah, and when you look at sort of like some of the beaten down areas, how do you just sort of distinguish between a sort of undervalued stock and a value trap?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. That's always very difficult, and you've got to try and avoid value traps, i.e. those you get stuck in for year after year after year. So you've got to be very disciplined in it. And I mean, it's okay if you're Warren Buffett. You can take a 10 or 15, 20-year view on a value trap or whatever. But he's made his money by buying really good companies. I mean, I wouldn't classify him as in the sort of deep value, but he likes to buy good companies at the right price, is how I pigeonhole him. And then he likes to hold them.
Yeah, he's done very well out of Apple, I think.
Yeah, I mean, give him his due. He is smart. You know? I mean, Apple's a great business. Amazon's another great business.
Do you own either Apple or Amazon or any of the fact?
I think we do. I mean, we do, but probably not enough of them. In fact, you couldn't own enough of them if you follow me. I mean, you just wanted to fill your boots with Amazon and Apple and Facebook, Google, etc. And the one that has surprised me is definitely Tesla.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming back. They're terrific businesses, and the argument is, I guess, is twofold. First of all, when they get bigger, they have a greater moat around them, networking effect, and therefore they will grow even faster than the overall market and continue to win market share. And the other factor is such that, you know, there's nobody out there who could possibly compete once you get to that sort of level. But you then got to sort of balance it with the valuation. And I looked at Amazon just recently, and I know it's never looked cheap, but it's on 100 times earnings. You've got things like Microsoft on 10 times sales. Even Apple's on 35 times PE. And you look at it and you think, from a value active investor, that lens, it's quite difficult to carry on riding it up. You've got to be...
Well, yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's so hard to, you sort of look at them and you think, my God, I should be selling these stocks, but if I sell them, I'll never get back in. So it's a really tough one.
So how do you actually make that decision when it comes to selling it on a value or an active basis? Because do you say 30% above my fair value? Do you say it's reached a certain level, my sort of portfolio, you know, sort of size-wise?
So two answers to that question. Luckily, I don't have to make that decision. I can criticize the fund managers for making that decision. Yeah. But usually just by top slicing.
Okay. Yeah, so, I must admit, I'm a value guy, and I haven't got it right. I sort of like make a sort of like a binary decision whether it's value or not. And
And top slicing is the way to do. You know, I say just keep going up, just take a bit off, a bit off, a bit off, and you're still running your winners that way.
Yeah. And what sort of be the maximum size you could get? You'd have. But if you're a value guy of the portfolio in one particular stock, would it be 5%, 10%?
Yeah, I think somewhere between 5 and 10% is really the maximum a fund manager would have in a stock. Yeah. So you don't want to get into a situation where it's 30% of a portfolio because it's done so well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got to that's why I mean, you've got to keep top slicing.
And what sort of like would be your sort of like expected returns going forward from now in terms of a sort of an active manager? Because I mean, we've all got used to sort of 8 or 9% per annum sort of compound over a long, long period. Would you expect that, or we have brought some of the gains forward?
Yeah, I think we've brought some of the gains forward myself. I think, you know, with the interest rate environment we're in, if you can make 5, 6, 7%, you're doing, I think you're doing pretty well going forward. But that's, I mean, hopefully you'll do much better than that by stock selection and so on. That would be my sort of index type performance.
Yeah. And what sort of potential risks do you see to sort of that scenario going forward, particularly in the short term? Is it the US elections? Is it the escalation of the US China trade dispute, which seems to be going on forever? Or is it Brexit? Even another COVID infection, which I don't see myself, but what do you see as sort of the potential curveballs that could be heading our way?
I don't know. You know, it'll be none of those, will it? Because they're all known. And, you know, as I've always said, it's something that comes completely out of nowhere, that like COVID. When we were sitting there saying markets were expensive at the beginning of the year, what could be hitting us? It would be the China war. It would be Trump re-election, all of these sort of things. So they're all known.
Yeah,
but it's what the next unknown is that worries me.
Did you see COVID coming at all?
No,
no.
I did actually. I did in a bit. It was funny. I did say to the founder of Revolut in January. I said this. I just urged him to complete the transaction. I remember And I said, this COVID thing does worry me slightly. I didn't think it would be as bad as it is. But I did slightly see it, but not to the extent that it affected the economy. Not to the extent it's decimated the economy.
Yeah. Did you adjust your portfolio accordingly, or is it just one of those?
Well, luckily, I'm not allowed anywhere near portfolios, so... no, we didn't. But my only point was, I remember saying to Nikolai at Revolut, I remember saying, look, just get this fundraising done, will you?
Yeah, sensible move. What about sort of like when the sort of the tide goes out, we have a number of sort of like companies that you start seeing the rocks appear, and that may be sort of like, you know, potential frauds or accounting problems and all this sort of stuff. We saw that at Wirecard, you know, Valerie Patisserie, NMC Health, etc. What do you look for in sort of like areas that you would sort of like, or any sort of red flags at all that you're a bit cautious of what you're being told?
Oh, gosh, that is a good question. I mean, in most of those, no one foresaw it. I mean, the one that everyone did foresee was Wirecard.
Mm.
I mean, the press were on to Wirecard sort of for a while. I don't think they foresaw Patisserie. I don't think they saw any of the others either. But, but certainly Wirecard was there to be seen. We're certainly there to be cautious about.
And would Aberdeen Asset Management, they would use sort of like forensic accounting or alternative data sources to correlate some of the group accounts and that sort of stuff if they got a bit suspicious?
Yeah, we would probably sell if we were a bit... we would certainly sell rather than go down the route of forensic accounting or whatever. But we would certainly question the management strenuously before we sold, though.
Yeah.
And if we felt we weren't getting the right answers, then we wouldn't have confidence in that management team, and our tendency would be to sell.
Yeah. Just coming back to the sort of the fund management industry, was there any sort of fallout at sort of like the higher end where, you know, Aberdeen and Standard Life sort of like operate from the sort of what happened with Neil Woodford and his funds, where they got the liquidity mismatch? Was there any sort of fallout on pooled funds at that level, or was it really just limited to the small cap side?
It was limited to really Neil's funds, probably. There wasn't a huge fallout, and for the industry as a whole, and certainly not for our funds, we didn't see a huge effect on it.
Yeah.
And I mean, everyone then did review their portfolios just to see what was in them. And luckily for us, I mean, we didn't have any sort of illiquid. Illiquid's the wrong word, because you can have illiquid quoted stocks, but we didn't have any serious amount of non-listed stocks in open-ended funds. And that's the issue that Neil had, was that he had them in open-ended funds, and then when he saw redemptions keep coming in, he just breached limits. And we call it an inadvertent breach, actually. It's not something he did advertent. Anything he did deliberately. He was unlucky. And maybe if he'd got through to now, you look at some of these valuations, they might have been through the roof, you know?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the other side of the trade, I mean, they took his positions at distressed levels.
Yeah. Oh my God, they've made out like bandits, haven't they?
They have. 10 times your money.
The buyers of his stakes, my God.
Yeah, it's been like Christmas come early, I think, for them.
Yeah, yeah.
Just on the finally on the sort of stock areas, you mentioned Astra, Unilever, Dunelm, etc. Are there any other sort of like big caps that maybe investors want to slide with the slide rule? Any of the banks at all? Any of the insurers? That sort of stuff. Obviously, you can't say have a look at Aberdeen Standard Life. But
yeah. Well, it looks reasonably priced. I mean, the good thing about us is we've got a very, very strong balance sheet, so that gives us a lot of optionality. No, I mean, those sort of stocks I do like. I'm a big fan of the Unilevers of this world, these sort of boring companies. I'm a big fan of Microsoft at the right price, Amazon at the right price, Asian stocks at the right price, and I would certainly, my own personal investments are all made just into our funds, especially our Asian funds. So yeah. I just like Asia. I like the culture. I like the work culture, the growth prospects. So just bored. Boring, dull stocks.
Yeah. I think investors sort of go forward if they are interested in things like Amazon and Microsoft and these huge, you know, Netflix, but mainly sort of like, you know, Amazon as well, and Facebook and Alphabet and these kind of guys, then the investors may get an opportunity at the US presidential elections, because if Joe Biden does get in, then he's probably going to hammer them on data privacy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's probably like the Standard Oil being split up, isn't it? Whenever that was, many, many years ago. Because these companies, they dwarf everything else.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you get to $2 trillion, that's big.
Yeah.
I think that's bigger than the whole of the FTSE 100 together.
Yeah, it's frightening, isn't it? It's absolutely frightening.
Any final tips for sort of investors? I mean, maybe sort of how you control your emotions in this volatility. I mean, when we had that huge dive down in March, April, any sort of final tips would you sort of like say investors what to do and what to look for and how to control themselves?
Do a bit of fundamental research yourself because it's easy, not easy, but it's not beyond any of us to do. Choose good management teams and just wait for the time to buy the stock, I would say, or buy the equity. I would and invest for the long term.
That sounds like Warren Buffett to me.
Yeah, well, I wish I was as rich as him.
I'm sure you haven't done too badly.
Thank you.
Well, many thanks, Martin. That's absolutely brilliant.
You.
Very insightful.
Thank you.
And I look forward to touching base again going forward.
Yeah. Look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Synergen, up 2%, £2. At four, Alba Mineral Resources, up 4.6% to 0.2. At three, Omega Diagnostics, up 2.3% to 6 pence. At two, Erasure Mining, down 2.2% to 22 pence. All the twos there. In fact, down 2.22% to 22 pence. And at one, Vela Technologies, it's a microcap, of course, investment company. It surged yesterday. That's up 6% to 0.133. All right. Top five most liked or most read RNSs are as follows. At five, it is C Machines. They signed an MOU with leading semiconductor company. At four, Supply Atme Capital Holdings and Company. At three, Beat Supply Project Production and Operational Cash Flow. At two, Arix Biosciences Interim Results for 6 months. And at one, Bushveld Minerals Vanadium Rental Partnership with Invinity. And that's seen a rise by 1% to 12.63. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.